All right. We left off in chapter 17 in the book of Exodus, and as you recall, that you know God has delivered His people. That now He's been testing them through their wilderness journey, and there's so much symbolism that's involved in these experiences they go through. Remember, I had shared with you a couple times already, and I think it's well to just keep in mind that all these things that these people went through, and that the Holy Spirit had Moses write down for our instruction, there for our reproof, there for our edification, there for our understanding. In other words, we take a good, hard, cold look at where they made their mistakes, spiritually speaking. And we need to do everything in our power, you know, with the grace of God, to avoid these same mistakes, because God's just not going to let us go in terms of we need to make some spiritual progress in our life. And if we don't learn our lessons at one point, He's going to have to deal with this again at the same point, maybe in a different way, at a different time, under different circumstances. I mean, this is one thing we're told in Hebrews, that every one of us that He calls His children, He's going to be disciplining us, okay, for the purpose of godliness, because we all need this discipline. You know, but the problem is, so many people don't learn their lessons. I mean, it's a fact, it's a sad fact, but there's some people that when they accept the Lord, they grow in leaps and bounds. It's just amazing how they grow. I think a lot of people, to begin with, they have a lot of zeal, a lot of enthusiasm, and a lot of excitement about the Lord, but then the trials set in and the difficulties come by, and one thing or another, you know, the arrogance or whatever happens to, you know, they have to contend with, and they lose that zeal, they lose that enthusiasm, they lose the joy, and they begin murmuring or griping or whatever. But, you know, if we don't learn our lessons, we're going to have to go through it again and again, just like these people are going to have to go through it here, okay? Let's just pick up the book of Exodus. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do with this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water will come out of it, and the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he named the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Okay, now here's, I think, another very interesting thing that we need to learn from. Remember when they first crossed the Red Sea? Okay, they had made a journey of about 39, 40 miles, a 3-day journey actually, down to Mara. And there they ran out of water, they got real thirsty, and then they got really agitated, real irritated, and they figured, "Hey, we're just going to die of thirst out here," and they began to grumble against Moses and Aaron. And then there was water, there was a big pool or lake of water, but it was all poison. It was all, you know, bitter. They couldn't drink it. And then, of course, God had to throw that, Moses throw this tree, this certain tree, into the water, and the waters became sweet. This was all rich with symbolism. He's trying to teach them a great deal as far as their dependency upon Him, as far as their being grateful, being thankful, as far as exercising their faith. All these things God had a reason for, but they didn't learn their lessons because instead they griped and they complained. But then God gave them the water after doing all the miracles before this. But then they didn't learn their lessons, so now they come, they get further on down the road. I try to measure exactly how far it is, but it's probably they went at least another 80 miles when they get to Rephidim, which is down here in the lower part of this wilderness of Paran. Okay, they get down there, and now they're out of water again. But they didn't learn their lessons. What they should have done the first time, they didn't learn it, was they had come before Moses, come before God, and ask God with prayer and supplication and thanksgiving for water. Okay, that's what we are told to do, and we're told that in Philippians, that make your request be known unto God with prayer and supplication and thanksgiving. And then God's peace will, you know, will guard our hearts and minds in Christ Jesus, and we, you know, we're not going to be anxious for these things, and God will provide it in due time. All right? Now, we look at what these people are going through, and you have to empathize with them. Okay, because a lot of us in our spiritual Christian walk, we're going to be in the same situation. We may not be thirsting for water, but we're going to be craving something where God is going to be testing us. And we need to turn to Him, you know, in prayer and turn it over to Him. Because in due time, He will answer our prayers and He will, you know, provide for our needs. But these people, they didn't learn it, so what does God do? He's gracious to them, and He performs this act for them to provide them with water. But I think there are a couple of things you need to keep in mind. First of all, it's easy for us to sit here in a comfortable living room and to look back and say, well, those people, they blew it. Those people, they don't, you know, they really should have done better than that, especially the second time around, which is true. They really should have. But try to put yourself in their shoes. I know when I was young and dumb early on as a Christian, sometimes I would fast, okay, and I would fast for like 3 days without any food, without any water, without anything to drink. Okay, I don't do that anymore because I look back and that was pretty foolish, okay. But I was doing it for spiritual reasons. But I know that by the time the second day is gone, all you can think about is water. I mean, you know, all you want to do is quench your thirst. And, you know, I mean, I work in a grocery store. I can remember just checking through things like, you know, frozen orange juice, stuff like that, and just the feel of something cold, you just want to put it to your mouth. And I say that because I kind of empathize with these people and their thirst. If you put yourself in their position, you know, they would much rather have gone back to Egypt or been enslaved in Egypt than to die of thirst. But God wasn't about to allow that to happen. Okay, but they didn't learn their lessons. Instead, they go to Moses, they go to Aaron, and they gripe, and they complain, and they're ready to stone him. This is how angry the people are getting, all right? And God now deals in a very miraculous way. But look what happens as the story unfolds. He says here that they quarreled with Moses. Then God told Moses to do what? He said, look, go stand before this rock on Horeb, and I'll be there before you, and then strike the rock, and it will yield its water. All right? Let's read this account again, because there's another account when we get into the book of Numbers. And it's not the same time. It's not the same situation. But it's very, very similar. And I want you to see the contrast between these two. All right? Because there's a very strong spiritual parallel that God is trying to bring forth here. Look at this. Look at that verse 5. Let's read this again. Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take in your hand your staff in which you struck the Nile and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water will come out of it, and the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders. Now, I want to read you the other account. The other account is in Numbers 20. You don't have to turn there, but in Numbers 20, I think, you know, if you contrast these, you tell me what's the difference here, okay? Because it says, and there was no water for the congregation and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. And again, they didn't learn their lessons a second time, so now a third time they don't have any water. And again, they don't learn their lessons. Again, they, you know, assemble against Moses and Aaron to gripe against them. This is what they said. And the people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord, why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? It's not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink. Now, this was their own fault at this particular time because they refused to go into the land of Canaan. I remember, we'll get to that later. But, you know, and then because they refused to go in because they said that the giants were going to kill them or the people of the Canaan were going to kill them, then God says, okay, you guys can go. You guys are all going to die out here in the desert, and your children, who you said I'm going to have slain, are the ones who are going to go in. Well, see, now they're turning everything on Moses. We're in this wilderness here. What are we doing here? There's no grapes. There's no figs. There's no pomegranates. There's nothing here. Okay, And you can imagine Moses' frustration in this. It was their own fault, but they're blaming it on Moses. And it says, then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly at the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now listen, you tell me what the difference is. Take the rod, and you and your brother and Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. Thus you shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and they said, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and the water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and the beasts drank. Now, what was the difference?
Second time he was told to speak to the rock.
Right. The first time he was told, hey, strike the rock. Take the rod, strike the rock, and it will yield its water. Okay? The next time, he's telling him, now just speak to the rock. But unfortunately, Moses really, really got out of control. He got in the flesh, and he blew it. And because he blew it, God said this to them, but the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. Now, here's the thing. Poor Moses, he had put up with these people for so many years, and now he's not even going to be able to go in a promised land because he blew it. Now, we may look at this and say, man, God is really, really harsh here. What, give the guy a break. But, okay, now here's the big difference, and here's the symbolism, because we read in Corinthians that the rock was who? Represented who? It was Christ. And it says the rock that followed them. Well, obviously, it wasn't a rock that followed them around. A rock was Christ, and what it meant was that God had brought forth water out of a rock more than once, and it was Christ that was there before the rock to bring it forth. But what it symbolizes is this: if the rock is Christ, he first told Moses, take the rod that you use to smite the Nile with. So in other words, this is a rod of judgment. And he says, stand before the elders of the congregation of Israel and strike the rock once, and it will yield its water. Okay? Now, the rock is Christ. The staff represents judgment, this wooden staff. Christ had to be smitten. We are told that in Isaiah, that he was smitten for our iniquities, right? He had to be smitten. He had to be struck down. He had to be, slain in order for us to be saved. But once he's been smitten, once he's been struck, then it opens the what? The living waters for all of us, right? And therefore, now we can drink freely from these living waters. Okay, now, the second time God told Moses, now, he didn't say strike the rock, he said speak to the rock. Now, here's the symbolism there, is that once Christ has died and rose for our sins, there's no need for him to die again. There's no need for him to be smitten again. All we need to do is appeal to him, for our needs. And, he's going to meet our needs abundantly. You see what I'm saying? But Moses failed in this area to really bring forth this strong, powerful symbolism that God wanted him to convey to his people. Instead, Moses was out of line. First of all, he called them rebels. And second of all, he said, shall we, meaning me and Aaron, bring forth water from you out of this rock. And then he took the darn staff and he waxed the rock twice. Okay? And then it brings out the water. God overruled Moses. Okay? God could have just said, no, you didn't do it the way I said, man, you blew it. But instead, he met the needs of his people. But poor Moses ended up having to suffer tremendous consequences because he was in the flesh, rather than in the spirit. And I think this is something that is very, very rich in symbolism in terms of what we need to learn from this. Here was a man who failed to do exactly what God told him to do, And what did it do? It forfeited his ministry. It cost him his ministry. He could no longer lead the people into the promised land. Instead, his sidekick, Joshua, his successor, Joshua, was the one to lead them into there. And it really broke Moses' heart, because when we read on, we find that Moses asked the Lord again and again, you know, oh, please let me go in there. And the Lord said no. And the Lord was gracious to him and says, I'll let you climb on Mount Nebo and you can look over and you can see the promised land, but you're not going in it. Okay, so I think it's a very, very powerful, you know, warning to all of us, but also to, especially I think to spiritual leaders, that we need to obey God and we need to follow His instruction. We need to do what He tells us and how exactly what He tells us to do and how He tells us to do it. You see the big difference here? That these people didn't learn their lesson. Again, I think that when we are in a situation where we are experiencing needs or wants, we need to bring it before the Lord with prayer, supplication, thanksgiving, praise, and we need to wait upon Him for His timing. Okay, because if we don't learn that lesson, then what's going to happen? He's going to have to bring us through it again and again and again and again. Okay, I think it was Watchman Nee who said something to the effect that we cannot avoid God's disciplines, but we can really prolong them. And I don't know, years ago there was, they're probably still going on, but you ever hear of basic youth conflicts? Mm-hmm. Okay, with Bill Gothard, I think 20-something years ago I went to one of those, and I think I remember in one of those he was talking about how people how young teenagers, how God sometimes has to deal with them. If, let's say, for example, they don't obey their parents, in other words, if they don't honor their parents, they don't show respect to their parents, you might have a young teenage girl, for example, who just simply says, who shows no real respect or honor to her parents. She's very rebellious. And she's maybe living at home and she's feeling like, man, I can't stand it here. I just want to get out of here. I want to be my own person. And so very often what happens is she will run off with the first Tom, Dick, or Harry that comes along on a white tornado saying, well, this is my knight in shining armor, and she'll take off with him. But then she'll find that he is far more tyrannical than her parents ever were. Okay, because she didn't learn her lessons of submission. She didn't learn her lessons of obedience or honoring her parents or respecting her parents. So now she's under a husband, you know, who really treats her in a harsh manner. And now she's got a more difficult thing to learn. And he also used the example of, let's say, a guy. Usually guys who are in gangs, and they're very rebellious or in and out of jail or whatever. And they think, hey, man, I'm sick and tired of living at home. I'm sick and tired of my parents. I'm sick and tired of people telling me what to do. I think I'm going to join the service. And a lot of times they end up joining the Marine Corps. And God will say, okay, you didn't submit to my dealings with you, with my hammering on you. Now I'm going to really use the sledgehammer. And he just puts them into the Marine Corps. And then they're really going to have to submit. Because if they don't submit, they're going to get broken. There's no doubt about it. Okay? And if they don't learn there, what happens? They usually end up in prison or in jail. And the Bible says that he who stiffens his neck after much reproof will sooner or later be broken beyond repair. So that's what I mean as far as learning God's lessons. I mean, I would sure like to be able to escape all of these disciplines and all of these lessons. I mean, it is difficult. But the thing is, we've got to really look at him and say, okay, Lord, what do you want me to learn in this? Help me to learn my lesson. Help me to learn it as quickly as possible so I can move on, okay? But you're never going to learn it with a wrong spirit, a wrong attitude, a rebellion, or grumbling, or murmuring, or griping, because you're just going to have to go through it again and again and again. Anybody have anything you want to add and share on to that particular segment? Okay, one more last thing. That's verse 7. Then he, Moses, named the place Massa, which means testing, or Meribah, which is quarreling. Because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? I think that's kind of significant, because he's naming these places. He named the other place Marah because of the bitterness they had there, the people showed towards Moses. Now he's talking, this is places of testing and a quarreling. And I don't know what you would want on your epitaph. Do you ever think of that? I mean, I personally would want to be able to have something that, hey, you know, here lies John Hunt. He fought the good fight and he finished the race. I mean, that's what I would want, you know. I mean, something of that nature. But it's almost like here in the desert, Moses is naming these particular places, and they almost become like epitaphs for the people, that they have failed there, that they failed misery here, or misery there, you know, and it's kind of written in stone, you know, chiseled in granite for the rest of the world to see their failure. Okay, now God isn't doing this to humiliate the people, but I think, again, it's an example for us, that, okay, what to avoid. Okay, now it says in its verse 8, then Amalek.
John,
yeah.
Want some trivia here.
Yeah.
I have written in my Bible, June 5th, 1990.
Yeah.
John Hunt's epitaph should read, per you, he tried to get people to take God seriously.
Oh, that's what I said. That's what I said. How long ago?
9 years ago.
9 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't work. Yeah. So now I'm trying, now I got a new one.
I'll
be darned.
Which one do you like the...
Huh?
Yeah. Which one do you like better?
Well, I feel like I failed at that one, so...
Oh,
I
bet, no. Try to get people to take God seriously.
You're going to outlive all of us anyway.
That would just be my Maribel, I tell you, right? Masa, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Verse 8 says, Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua said, did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses and Aaron and Ur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, and Aaron and Ur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other side. Thus his hands were steady until the sunset. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword, and the Lord said to Moses, write in this a book of memorial, and recite to Joshua that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it to the Lord, the Lord is my banner, and he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. Okay, here's another situation I think is just really rich with symbolism in terms of its meaning for us. First of all, you got Amalek. Anybody who remember when we went through the book of Genesis, who Amalek is a descendant from? Okay, Amalek is a descendant from Esau. Now, if you read in Hebrews, we are told that it says that see to it that there is no immoral or godless person among you like Esau who sold his birthright for a mess of porridge, right? So Amalek really represents the flesh in this respect, that Esau was a man of the flesh. Esau was an immoral, godless man who lived only to satisfy his appetites. Okay, we are told that we need to see to it that we don't become a person like that. All right? Now, here's what's interesting. If we read in Deuteronomy, okay, it gives you just a little bit more detail of just what Amalek did, because it's in Deuteronomy 25. It says that when God tells Moses, he says, remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt, how he met you along the way and attacked among you the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore, it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you the rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. You must not forget. Now, here's the symbolism. Here's what we need to learn. Amalek represents the flesh, okay? But here's what happened, is that the people were moving in stages. What I mean by stages is they were moving tribe by tribe, following the cloud, you know, following the Lord through the desert. And it says the weary and the sick among them, the tired, they were kind of lagging behind in this march. And then Amalek ambushed the stragglers. And he started slaying them and killing them. Men, women, and children, I guess old people or whoever, the sick, the lame. He started attacking them. All right? But then Joshua is given the commission to go forth, okay, and to fight against Amalek. Now, here's the thing. God could have wiped them all out with a glance. Instead, he has Joshua go out there with a hand-picked army to do battle with him. All right? Remember, now here's a different situation. Remember when God delivered them from the Egyptians as they went through the Red Sea? He said, it just simply said, hey, all you need to do is stand by and watch the salvation of the Lord. They didn't have to do anything. But now they have to go out and fight. And Amalek, like I said, represents the flesh. And keep this in mind when we're talking about the flesh. Because in Galatians, we are given a list of what the deeds of the flesh are. Because he says this, now the deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strifes, jealousies, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envyings, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these, of which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. All right? Now this is what the flesh represents. And now here Joshua goes out there and he's fighting the Amalekites. But it's a seesaw. It's going back and forth, and it all depends upon prayer. Because Moses is up there holding his hands up to God, and he's praying. But man, his hands get heavy. Try holding your hands up there for a while. I mean, you don't even have to be holding anything. I remember, in Marine Corps boot camp, and one of the things they had is holding our rifles up. I mean, both hands is holding out, stretched, because we were being punished for something, and we had to just hold them there. And the drill instructor goes back into the duty office, and we just hold him there. And I remember holding it there, and after the minutes started going by, I mean, my arms just started shaking. It was shaking so bad, I remember that I was holding the muzzle of my rifle with this hand, my left hand, and my right hand had the butt of the rifle, but my right hand just dropped it, and it was going like this, just spastic. I couldn't even get it up there. I mean, and you're just in absolute agony and pain, you know, trying to hold this thing up. Well, you know, if you just hold your hands up there, okay, even without any weight, eventually just the weight, gravitational pull on your arms is going to do the same exact thing. It's just going to be so excruciating as far as the pain is concerned, you can't keep them up. But every time Moses would let his hands down out of exhaustion, they'd start losing the battle. So then Aaron and Ur, they put a stone under him. He sat him on it, and they held his hands up, and they held him up till sunset. The battle went on all day long. Joshua finally got the victory, and then God said, as far as Amalek was concerned, he said that not only was he going to blot his name out, but he did tell them that there would be war from generation to generation with Amalek. Let me see, what verse was that? It's the last one. He said, the Lord swore and will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. Now, here's the thing. Every single generation has to deal with Amalek. Amalek is our flesh. Amalek is our fallen nature. By nature, within us is Amalek in terms of being selfish, self-centered, egotistical, proud, lustful, arrogant. You know, all of these different things we have to contend with, and every single generation has to contend with it, don't they? All right? I mean, we may look at some of these stained glass windows of saints, and they got the halo around them, and we would think that, you know, with the serene look on our faces that they're given, you would think that they never knew what it was to really struggle with passions, or really struggle with something like anger, or really struggle with, lust, or these type of things.
I was going to make a comment.
Okay.
About the flesh and relating to Amalek. The flesh doesn't attack us where we're strong. It attacks us where we're lagging behind spiritually.
Good.
So like the stragglers.
Good.
That's where we're weak.
Right.
It attacks us there.
Right.
And it's kind of despicable.
Right, right.
Doesn't it attack us in our strength where we can win?
Right. Well, that's exactly right. Well, remember what happened to Paul, when he had a thorn in the flesh. And, three times he inquired of God to remove it. And Jesus said, hey, my grace is sufficient. And he said, my power is made perfect in weakness. But it's interesting that you did mention about the stragglers, because that's another spiritual, I think, symbolism that's there. In other words, God was moving, all right, in a cloud. And the cloud was obviously moving very slow as he was leading these people along, right? And they were going along in stages, and he was leading them. But God wasn't racing ahead of anybody. So what I'm saying is, okay, even though they were weak, even though they're, you know, were tired or straggled, whatever, I really do believe that that God was not outrunning them. They could have kept up, but they were just getting tired of the whole thing, all right? And they were just getting weary of it all, you know, going through this dry, arid desert, and the whole thing seemed so monotonous, so tiring, so wearisome. Have you ever been there? Well, that's the way these people felt. But even though you feel that way, you can still keep up by continuing to read your scriptures, continue to pray, continue to go to church, continue to fellowship, continue to do these things. You're going to be keeping in step, even though you don't feel it, you're making much progress. Okay, but granted, once you start falling behind, then it's very easy for your flesh to take over. Okay, once you stop reading the Word, once you really don't become diligent about that, it's easy for your flesh to take over. And especially if you're not praying, okay, with the intensity you need to be praying with, then your flesh could take over very easily. That's why I think the symbolism here is so powerful. There's two things that are necessary. You know, intercessory prayer, praying constantly that God will give you the strength to overcome the weaknesses of the flesh. Plus, you've got to use His Word, the sword, in order to overcome it. If you fail in these two areas, then the chances are you're going to be like the stragglers who Amalek was able to annihilate. And then it says you're going to have war from generation to generation. And I think this is why God allowed this to be orchestrated this way. He could have dealt with Amalek without a problem, but He wanted to leave us an example of what we need to deal with, and that's our flesh. Now, the only way it can be dealt with is constant, continuous prayer. If you see somebody who's backsliding back into the world as far as their flesh is concerned, you know, you got to keep that person, uphold that person in prayer, constantly uphold them in prayer, because it says, the victory didn't come till sunset. In other words, hey, the victory went, the battle went on all day, and the battle's going to go on our entire life to the day we're dead. And that's kind of really disheartening to me, to think that, man, I'll never get to the place where I can look back and say, oh, man, I finally made it. Every day is a struggle. With our passions, with our lusts, with the difficulties we've got to deal with. The Bible says, hey, Jesus said, pick up your cross daily, deny yourself, and follow me. And Paul talks about he said, I am crucified with Christ. And if you look at what it means to be crucified with Christ, in other words, when Jesus said, pick up your cross daily and follow me, everybody knew back in the days of Christ, when you had the Roman execution as far as crucifixion was concerned, when you went out to be crucified, hey, there was a couple things you got to keep in mind. You had no more plans of your own. You weren't going to say, well, I'm going to be home for lunch, or I'll be back for dinner. You know, hey, you were finished. You were through. And once you were nailed to that cross, you were facing in one direction. Okay, you couldn't turn around. Right? And you recognized that, hey, my only future is death. Okay, well, we're talking spiritually here, and that's what has to happen to the flesh, okay, that it has to be put to death, it has to be crucified with Christ. But that's Amalek, all right? Does anybody ever want to add or share what we read there? Excuse me. One last thing before we move on to the next chapter. It does say in verse 15, Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. A banner was a sign of victory. In other words, you know, we can't defeat Amalek. He's just too powerful. But by the grace of God, we can do it. And that's the only way we're going to be able to overcome the flesh. Okay, it's through the power of the Lord, through prayer, and through His scripture. Okay, if nobody else has anything to add, let's go ahead and read this chapter 18. I think we can get through this. It's very quick reading. It says in verse 1, it says, Now Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel and his people, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife, Zipporah, after he had sent her away, and the two sons, of whom one was named Geshem, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife and his Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the Mount of God. And he sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming with you, with your wife and her two sons with you, with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other their welfare, and went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law that all the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for the Israel's sake, and all the hardships that they had befallen them on the journey, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel in delivering them from the hand of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and a sacrifice for God and Aaron, and came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. Okay, before we go any further, let's just back up a little bit. Jethro is Moses' father-in-law. He's also referred to as a priest of Midian. Okay, so he was a priest of God. Okay, and this is speculative on my part. Okay, there's I'm trying to piece as much as I can together here, and I obviously could be wrong. But here's what's kind of interesting: is that now Moses is down. He's down here in this wilderness here, where actually he's very close to where Moses' father-in-law dwelt, and he's down there. Now, what's interesting is he says that he's coming to Moses with his wife Zipporah and her and Moses' two sons. But if you remember when we read a few chapters earlier, Moses, when he set out for Egypt, he had his wife with him. Remember? Along with his two sons. But there's something happened along the way there that I think caused a great deal of consternation between him and his wife. And he ended up sending her back. Now this is speculative, but remember on the way to Egypt, what happened is the Lord appeared to Moses and he was about to kill Moses. Why?
He didn't circumcise his son as he was supposed to.
Okay, now what apparently happened is this. Okay, it only talks about one son. Apparently it was the younger son, Eleazar. Because apparently he had already circumcised Geshurim, his older son. But apparently his wife did not like that at all. And there was a real... This is speculative. There must have been a real falling out or a real disagreement between the two of them about that. But then on the way there, God is going about to slay Moses, and God reveals that the reason is because one of his sons, his younger son, was not circumcised. So Zipporah goes and circumcises him and throws her son's foreskin at Moses' feet and calls him a bridegroom of blood to her. So there was a lot of contention there. There was a real spirit of animosity on her part towards Moses. Now, what happened to Moses? Apparently, he followed this covenant practice with his older son, and he didn't do it with his younger one. Okay? And apparently, it's because his wife did not like this idea at all. But nevertheless, God was about to kill him for that. And I think it's very important that we understand the reason why. It's because Moses is about to be used by God in such a mighty way, as a matter of fact, in more of a mighty way than he's ever used anybody on the face of this earth, apart from Christ, okay? He's going to use him in a powerful way. But, he has to enter into the covenant. In other words, he has to be obedient to the covenant himself before he can lead other people into this covenant to be obedient with it. So, anyway, long story short, if I can do this, in other words, there was a contention there. And I believe at that particular point, Moses said, threw his hands up and said, "Hey, listen, this isn't working. I'm going to go to Egypt. You go back to your dad. You go back to him. Take the two sons back." And she probably said, "Well, good riddance," when she left. So, I mean, there seemed to be a kind of a falling out there. But then again, I don't want to be too harsh on Zipporah either. Moses may have felt like, hey, this may be really a dangerous undertaking, so, maybe you better go back there or whatever. The reason I don't think, let's say, for example, that she went to Egypt with him is because, let's just say that she went to Egypt, she saw all these miracles, she crossed the Red Sea, and then Moses, let's say, okay, said, "Why don't you go ahead to your father-in-law?" I don't believe that was the situation because she would have related everything to her father-in-law of all the miracles that God had performed, right? But here, Jethro Moses is telling him, and Jethro is eating it up like this is the first time he's heard of it. So in other words, Moses' wife never did go to Egypt. All right. So he meets his father-in-law, and there's a real rejoicing on Jethro's part. And I think this is probably the first person that Moses really has witnessed to in this sense. Everybody else had witnessed or seen or experienced God's miracles. But now he witnesses to his father-in-law of everything that God had done, and then Jethro is really rejoicing, and he said, man, this, you know, there's nobody like God. All the other gods are just, you know, they're nothing in comparison. So he's really entering into a deeper, you know, understanding of the God that he's been serving. Okay, and he rejoices with that, and then he offers a sacrifice to God, and the elders join him in this worship ceremony. But now, what also transpires, it says, the day after that, it says in verse 13, and it came about the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around about Moses from morning until evening. Now, when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone and sit and judge all the people and stand about you from morning until evening? And Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, it comes to me, and I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his laws. And Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you are doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you, and you cannot do it alone. Now listen to me. I shall give you counsel, and God be with you. You be the people's representative before God, and you bring this dispute to God, and teach them the statutes and the laws, and make known to them the way in which they are to walk and the work they are to do. Furthermore, you shall select out of all the people's able men to fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place them over as leaders of thousands and of hundreds or of fifties and of tens, and let them judge the people at all times, and let it be that every major dispute they will bring to you, but every minor dispute they themselves will judge. So it will be easier for you, and it will bear the burden with you. And if you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you shall be able to endure, and all these people also will go to their place in peace. So Moses listened to his father-in-law, did all that he had said, and Moses chose able men and made them heads over the people and leaders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, of tens. And they judged the people of all at all times. The difficult disputes they would bring to Moses, but every minor dispute they themselves would judge. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way into his own land. Now here I think it's kind of an interesting thing. I've read commentaries where some people have believed that Moses, when he followed Jethro, his father-in-law's advice, he should never have done that because God never commissioned him to do that. But I think, hey, if you read this all the way through, especially that verse 23 makes it very clear that Jethro is giving him some very godly counsel, very wise, common sense advice. And Jethro concludes it by saying, if this is what the Lord commands, in other words, let me give you some advice here. Let me give you some suggestions here. And if the Lord approves it, you know, you really need to do it. So obviously the Lord did approve it. But some people have argued, well, Moses should have never have done this because what this led to was, remember what they refer to as the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin was basically 70 different elders that stood before the people to judge them. And they were that council that ended up condemning Jesus to death. All right? And they say that the Sanhedrin really had its birthplace here with Jethro's advice. But that's neither here nor there. Okay, in terms of the fact that, okay, the Sanhedrin, simply because it became filled with a bunch of corrupt men, it doesn't mean that God still didn't ordain this because of the wisdom of it. All right? Here's the wisdom of delegation. Poor Moses. I don't think that Moses was a man who wanted to hang on to power. I think that's very obvious. God referred to him as the humblest man alive, and he was the one who was very reluctant to take the reins of power. But he, nevertheless, when he was, I think he was very, very conscientious about his responsibility before God. So he, you know, wanted to do everything he could to make sure that people got the right advice, right counsel, whatever. But then Jethro gives him, I think, some very sound advice. All right, in terms of saying, you're going to wear yourself out and you're going to wear these people out. He'd wear the people out simply because they've been standing in line for days and days and days just to get a hearing before Moses. So the important thing is that they've delegated this responsibility, and they delegated it to what kind of people? Because this is what's very important about this. he said that what you need to do is you need to select certain kind of men. In verse 21, furthermore, you shall select out of all the people able men who fear God. First of all, they had to be capable men, but also needed to fear God. The two go hand in hand. We may have a lot of capable people as far as leadership today, but they have no fear of God. And so this is why we're in such a mess that we are in today, right? Able men who fear God, men of truth. Look at the qualities here. Don't you just wish that we had leaders like this today, especially in our political realm? I mean, just read it. Men who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain, and you shall place these over them as leaders of thousands. I mean, this is the kind of leadership that we need. I mean, the church needs this desperately, but I think this country needs this so badly. Well, this country has just become so corrupt and is so immoral, so godless, and you look at our leadership and you can see why. There's absolutely no wisdom. They may be very capable men in a lot of respect, but they have no common sense, they have no wisdom. Why? There's no fear of God. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Most of these men are not men of truth. Their lying tongues have just become proverbial. This is what we have to deal with today. But if you could find this kind of leadership, you'd obviously have a situation where, you know, the people themselves would be extremely blessed. But then again, it's only a reflection of the people. We wouldn't have this president today. There's no way, if we didn't have the same type of people. This is what we want. Anyways, then Moses just simply takes the advice of his father-in-law, and then he bids his father-in-law farewell, and he goes on his way. Does anybody have anything you want to add or share to what we read tonight?